I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro, popping in to say we've edited this podcast a little for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. A few months ago, I got a voicemail. It was from a child care center in Washington, D.C. That's where I lived in 2020 when I found out I was pregnant with my daughter. And right when I found out, I put my name on a bunch of childcare waitlists per the advice of my other parent friends. A few months later, I got this job and my family moved to Vermont very soon after my daughter was born. We navigated waitlists here. She got into a childcare center in Chittenden County, and that was that. And then I got this voicemail. Like I said, it was from a childcare center in Washington, D.C. And they said they had a space in their infant classroom for me, for my daughter. The only problem was 4 years had passed. My daughter is very much not an infant anymore, and we don't live in D.C. Hearing that voicemail made me thank my lucky stars that we'd gotten off a waitlist here in Vermont. And it gave me deep empathy for the many, many families who are still waiting for that call. Today on the show, we are going to talk early childhood education. Over the past few years, Vermont has been taking some pretty groundbreaking steps to make it more accessible and affordable for families. A year and a half ago, last summer, Vermont started charging a payroll tax of 0.44% to fund childcare subsidies for families and grants for childcare providers. Today, we're going to see how it's going and what's changed. We'll talk with one of the state senators who helped create the law, Ruth Hardy, and one of the state employees who is in charge of its rollout. But first, we are joined from Denver, Colorado, by Elliot Haspel, a nationally recognized child and family policy expert. He's also a senior fellow at Capita, a nonprofit focused on children and families. Elliot, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So tell us, sometimes it can be kind of hard to figure out what is going on from inside the system that you're talking about. So from an outsider's perspective, how is Vermont's new early childhood funding system going?
Best I can tell from the outside, Vermont's Act 76 system is really leading the nation in a lot of ways. And Vermont is in the vanguard of a very small number of states that are stepping into the gap left by this badly broken childcare system. And it's worth, you know, taking a moment to remember that. Childcare is what the U.S. Treasury Department says is in market failure. The laws of supply and demand don't apply as they should. There's because we treat what really is more of a public or social good, not something that's more like a public school or a library or a fire department, we treat it like this private market good, like, you know, getting a gym membership. And so what Act 76 did, putting in, you know, all of this public money, $120 million a year, is it started to fix the broken economics of the system. It hasn't fixed it all the way, but I know from following from afar that upwards of 100 new childcare programs have opened in the past year and a half, around 1,000 new slots have been created. And for a state that, you know, you all don't have that many young children, is really an impressive achievement at a time when lots of other states facing similar challenges are seeing their childcare systems shrink.
Elliot, help us dive a little bit deeper into why childcare costs so much. Why is it so expensive for a childcare facility to run a business?
A great question. And it's really because the fixed costs are incredibly high. So when you're taking care of a bunch of small humans, you need a bunch of large humans, right? The child to adult ratios need to be really low. And so, like, I was a fourth grade teacher at the beginning of my career. And at one point, I had like 34-year-olds in my classroom. That was probably many, but 1 to 30, right? That's a ratio. Think about how many people a restaurant server or an airline, you know, gate agent serves in the shift. In childcare, you need to have one adult for 4 infants, you know, one adult for 6 or 7 or 8 toddlers. The ratios are so low that you can't, there's no sort of innovation, there's no entrepreneurial solution to this. because it just costs a lot of money, and it should. Like, some things cost a lot of money, and you think about how much Vermont or other states put in, you know, per child in a public education system, which is its own conversation, mm-hmm. compared to what you put into to childcare, it's markedly, markedly less. And so that's really the challenge. It's not that these providers are trying to, you know, make some undue profit. In many cases, actually, they're charging less than they need to run a sustainable business where they're paying their staff a family-sustaining wage, where they have the facility that in the you know, outdoor learning environment that they should. In many cases, even though you're charging parents kind of this incredibly high amount of fees, it's not as much as you need to charge. And that's one of the things that Act 76 tried to fix by putting public money in the gap. Because otherwise, you just have this yawning gap of funding, which can either be filled by charging parents more, paying workers less, which is really hard to do, or closing.
Now, legislators, when they passed this law that we're talking about, which is commonly referred to as Act 76, they and lobbyists for this effort made an argument to the public saying that it is worth it to charge a payroll tax to everybody to fund this service that not every Vermont family is going to use. Maybe you don't have kids, or your kids are out of the system already. They're grown adults. Talk to us about that argument. Why was it a winning one that a state like Vermont should invest in something like this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would kind of harken back again to public education. So if you think about why do we have public schools in this country, and you had people like Thomas Jefferson making arguments for them, because it defends our democracy. It helps make sure you have an educated citizenry. It makes sure that, you know, does help parents be able to work and be productive. It really is a form of social infrastructure that helps, you know, neighbors connect with one another. It's all of these benefits that go so beyond the individual who is benefiting from it that we ask across the country, whether or not you have kids, you're going to pay into a public education system. And if you're a business, through corporate property taxes, you're going to pay into a public education system. Well, what we know now, which we didn't know back in the 19th century, is that all of that applies to young children as well. Learning starts at birth and goes on, does not start when you enter kindergarten, right? Parents need to be able to work in the early years, just like they need to be able to work in the school-aged years. And childcare programs have all of these social benefits of helping create their neighborhood assets. They create connectivity among parents. And so, and what Vermont has done, and what I hope the rest of the country is paying attention to what you all have done, is say, this is, the benefits are so widespread that it is worth paying with the public purse, which means that we're going to ask taxpayers, in a lot of cases, businesses, to be able to step up and help fund this. And that's really, really important. And I think the next step for Vermont is going to be looking at the workforce, because again, the quality and sort of scope of a childcare system is really either constrained or made abundant by the strength and of the workforce.
So at the same time, Vermonters are struggling with affordability and high taxes. It's going to be a main issue in this year's legislative session, which just kicked off. And this law we're discussing today, again, it's funded by a payroll tax, which is a tax that's paid on the wages and salaries of employees of a business. First, is that how early childhood is funded in other states that have made some of these investments or have, say, universal pre-K?
It's not actually. So Vermont is the only state I'm aware of that uses a payroll tax to as the primary funding source for state childcare funding. Other states like Massachusetts, has funds theirs mostly through tax on high net worth individuals. Washington State has a capital gains tax. New Mexico taps their natural sort of gas and oil resources, which obviously most states don't have. But there's no one answer to how you can fund childcare. What I really appreciate about the payroll tax actually is, in many ways, businesses, not in a negative way, but in many ways, businesses are freeloaders on America's childcare system, because what money does exist coming from parents and coming from kind of meager state subsidies in most states is supporting the parents in being able to work. It is supporting those businesses in their bottom line and in the vibrancy of their community in their state. And so I think the payroll tax is a way that makes sense to ask businesses to and employers really step up and support a public system. And one thing I was really impressed by is during the debate over Act 76, you had business leader after business leader after business leader coming up to the Vermont legislature and testifying. And I've watched these hearings. They essentially said, if you need to tax us to do this, tax us, because it is so worth it. We will make back that money in no time. And they can also pass
that cost back onto the consumer, to their customers, right?
They can. It's true. It is a small tax. I mean, 0.44% isn't very much. And my understanding, and again, I'm not in Vermont, mm-hmm. my understanding from following it from afar, is that businesses and have largely been pleased with, obviously business community isn't a monolith, have not heard a lot of blowback coming from the business community. And so I think it is working as intended, best as I can tell.
In Londonderry, we have Stefania calling in. What is your question or your comment?
Hi, Michaela. Thanks for taking my call. I have three kids, and with my older two, I have kindergarten, preschool, and a one-year-old. And with my first two, it was really hard finding childcare. Pretty much impossible. We had to really hodgepodge things together and get a nanny. And then in the last year, I had to take a lot of time off work and basically had my third baby home with me alone. And then in the fall, an in-home daycare opened up in my town, which now my third kid goes to. And it's been life-changing. And from what I understand, she got a grant from the state to open. And it's been revolutionary for me being able to work and my family. So I am so encouraging of the state helping to fund these programs in such a rural community.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for sharing that experience of this law potentially really changing the situation for your family there in Londonderry. Elliot, that's what lawmakers here are hoping to hear, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's great to hear that. It's exactly what we should be hearing. And I think it's a sign of the success of the law. I mentioned, Vermont is expanding at the time many other states are contracting. It's worth noting across the country, we've lost more than half of those in-home child cares in the past 20 years. So to see those types of programs, these in-home family child cares expand, which I understand is around half of the expansion so far, is really exciting. It's exciting for rural areas. It's exciting because those can be really, really good options for parents. And so again, I think that is a sign of why the public money, why something like Act 76 is so needed, and why I point a lot of people around the country when they ask me what states to pay attention to. I say, look at Vermont, because you all are one of the very few states that are seeing those sort of expansion stories.
Mm. Well, we love when people look at us, so thank you. Let's go next to Lisa in Alberg. Lisa, what are your thoughts on this conversation we're having today about early childhood education?
Hi, good morning. I am so excited to be talking about this. I live in Alberg, which is a very small rural community on the border. And we have been working for the last 6 years to build and fund a child care center. It's called the Alberg Family Clubhouse. And we have been working and fundraising and getting grants in place and collecting bottles and getting all kinds of community support. But it has been a very arduous, time-consuming process. And Act 250 has really been one of the things that has been very hard to deal with. First of all, it's very, very expensive. Act 250 cost our little nonprofit organization thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that could have gone into the budget for construction costs, for, site planning, for all of the equipment that's going to be needed for the children. But this is a need that we saw within the community that really needed to be addressed, because there really wasn't any kind of place for children to have daycare or an after-school program. And, we need to travel as workers into Burlington or other areas to find employment. And there's no safe, convenient place to leave our children. And so it has been a 6 year long process, and it's sorely needed in all kinds of small little communities. And if our little community of Alberg can come together and get an executive board together and form a nonprofit and do all the things that need to be done. It should be able to be done everywhere in all the small communities of Vermont. But
Lisa, I'm so sorry. I'm going to jump in here, and I'm glad you brought up Act 250. We're going to have a state senator joining us in just a few minutes, and I want to make sure to pose that question to her about what can be done to kind of ease the permitting process for small businesses like yours that are trying to open up early childhood education centers when there's a very high need. Elliot Haspel, before we let you go, I want to get your thoughts on one other issue that is very close to Vermonters' hearts right now, which is this the issue with our public education financing system, which is very complicated. I won't ask you to dive into it too deeply, but we've been criticized from within by having one of the highest per pupil spending rates on public education compared to most other states. And I know the way that we are funding early childhood in the state through this payroll tax is very, very different from how we fund public education. They're two separate systems. But I do wonder, since we're sort of having these conversations in parallel, do you think that there's a way that this a high investment is a sign of the state highly valuing early childhood education, or could it also be the sign of an inefficient system that needs fixing?
Yeah, I understand that question. And, you know, I started my career in kind of K-12 education, so I know what you're talking about. I would contrast this by saying, not knowing the specifics of Vermont's education debate, that childcare is a very young and in some cases is a growing, emerging system. So remember, public money is not coming in right now there's no bloat at the moment. There isn't like this massive amount of administration. Those questions just don't really apply to the childcare system, because the childcare system has been so starved and neglected of funding for decades that this is even just getting it on its feet. And like I said, even Act 76, even with the $120 million coming in, isn't actually enough. It's a midpoint, not an endpoint, particularly when you think about early childhood educators and making sure that there's a pipeline of well-trained, well-compensated educators that are going into these programs and caring for these young brains and developing brains and bodies. In this case, funding is taking a system, and it is just taking it out of the desert, and it is giving it water, and it is letting it grow and flourish. I think those conversations about efficiency, I wish that was the conversation we were having about childcare, was do we have too much money? Isn't it inefficient? But right now we're still in this phase of just building it up from what really, again, has been just decades of neglect, because we've not treated it as if it has a lot of social value. We've treated it very much as an individual family responsibility, and it's your fault if you can't figure it out. And that just doesn't work for families, doesn't work for educators, and it doesn't work for kids.
Elliot Haspel is a child and family policy expert and a senior fellow at Capita, a nonprofit focused on children and families. Elliot, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now is Senator Ruth Hardy. She's a Democrat representing Addison County, and she's considered one of the architects of this early childhood education law known as Act 76. Senator Hardy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Michaela. It's great to be here with you.
So, Senator Hardy, from your vantage point, how do you feel like this law is going? How many new centers have opened up? How has it made childcare more affordable? How have you worked towards your goals?
Well, I think it's been a really great success. Elliot stole a lot of the things I was going to mention to you. Thanks, Elliot. He's a wealth of knowledge and was really helpful in creating this law as well. And as he mentioned, there have been 90 new childcare programs, more than half of those family home care programs, 1,000 new spots created across the state, and over 1,600 families have now entered the system since Act 76 was passed. 1,600 families who now qualify for state subsidies to help them pay for the childcare. So it's been a huge success. So the stats show that. And then just anecdotally, over the last year, I've been to more new childcare program openings, grand opening celebrations, than ever before. And it's been really, really exciting. And like several of your callers have mentioned, a lot of these have been in small towns, not in the big hubs. They've been in the big hubs, but they've also been in small towns. In my district in Addison County, for example, a new childcare program opened in Salisbury, in their town offices. And then a new program is now opening in Addison in their old school building. There was a family home program opening in Ripton. So these are the small towns that I represent. And in addition to huge programs or large programs opening in Middlebury, which is the biggest town in my district. So across the board, we've just seen new programs opening and more families getting access to childcare.
Now, Governor Phil Scott vetoed this bill when it first came out. That veto was overridden. He wanted it to be funded in a different way. I'm curious if you continue to hear any pushback on the payroll tax, especially in this climate that we're in right now, where there is so much scrutiny on our taxes here in the state and on how we fund public education.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I have certainly heard people who are concerned about the use of the payroll tax. Most of those people who have expressed those concerns to me are not people who have young children. So there are people who feel like it's unfair that we're using a payroll tax to fund early childhood education. And it's fair for people to be concerned. I hear and feel it myself, but also understand this feeling that taxes were increased too much last session, largely because of the large property taxes. And it was sort of a bad coincidence that the payroll tax happened at the same time. But I would say, similar to what Elliot said, is that this payroll tax is funding childcare slots to enable parents to be able to access jobs and to contribute to the economy and to contribute to their family's bottom line. So I think the economic arguments for why early childhood education is important, it allows businesses to access workers to fill jobs, and it allows families to access, money to support their own family by being able to work.
Well, let's bring in a caller. We have John over in Hanover, New Hampshire, calling in. John, what are your thoughts?
Hi. As I said to the screener, I worked in daycare, in New Hampshire and Vermont, 50 some odd years ago. And I've always thought that the funding system for schools writ large is absolutely upside down. There's nobody that has more effect on a child's or a person's life than somebody working in a daycare center. It's just that's always the way I've felt about it. And I agree with, you mentioned that you got some information from businesses or corporate people who said, if you need to tax us, tax us. There's nothing more important than this. And I happen to agree with that very, very much.
John, thank you for calling in. And yes, a number of businesses did come out in support of Act 76, this legislation we're focused on today. Thank you for your call. Let's add one more voice to the conversation here. Janet McLaughlin is the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Children and Health and Families. Their Child Development Division works to implement the law that we are discussing today. Janet, welcome.
Hello, good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us. So a big part of your job right now is the implementation of Act 76. And the number of families who are eligible has really changed over the past year and a half since this all first started. Can you kind of give us a briefing on who is eligible, how that works?
Sure. So with Act 76, Vermont now has the most financially inclusive childcare financial assistance program in the nation. So the income limits increased significantly. And so right now, as an example, for a family of four could earn up to $180,000 annually. And they could still qualify for assistance if they work, they're in training, or they have another approved reason for needing childcare. For families that are up at those higher limits, it would be a partial support. It's not everybody, it's not they're gonna full free care for everybody, but it is designed to offset those costs so that people can continue to work if that's what they're, you know, as they choose to do and stay in their chosen profession and do those jobs we need them to do as Vermonters.
Mm. Now, as we've talked about with Senator Hardy, some of the resources from Act 76 have gone towards child care centers, helping them open mm-hmm. up. Can you talk to us about, like, not just how many have opened? We've heard about 90, but in what parts of the state? I know we had a concern from a caller earlier about Act 250 kind of standing in the way of some of those opening up. So, Senator Hardy, I would love to get your thoughts on that. But first, Janet McLaughlin.
Yeah, I think the other major change to the Child Care Financial Assistance Program was a dramatic increase in the amount of money that the state pays on behalf of families for financial assistance. And so those rates rose between 35% and 70%, depending on a program's characteristics. So now we have more families eligible, more families participating, and the state is paying more for those families. So it's really changing the financial picture for childcare programs so that they can begin to pay their staff more, begin to pay benefits, and that really impacts their sustainability and their quality overall. We also have made some investments just as direct payments to programs. We allocated $21 million out to 803 childcare programs to support their readiness and their sustainability, while we have been putting the other pieces in place for childcare financial assistance.
Mm. So while this is all going on, Senator Hardy, there are folks like our caller from Aalborg who says they have the money and the personal commitment to open a childcare center, but it's been hard to do because of all of the Act 250 land use and zoning regulations. Is there crossover at the State House in Montpelier between folks who are working on Act 250 reform and early childhood education?
Well, yes. I am not an expert yet on Act 250, although my new committee has jurisdiction over Act 250. So I will certainly be learning more and more and putting my knowledge about childcare into that mix. I have heard of some programs that have had some challenges, not just with Act 250, and I do want to make sure that people understand that there are also local zoning regulations that may be impacting these centers.
Yes.
Sometimes people put it all in the Act 250 bucket, but it's really can be state and local zoning. So I will definitely be looking into that more. There's still a conversation on the table about Act 250, and now that I've heard that from a few people, I certainly will. It's piqued my interest. I will make sure I look into it.
Well, let me share an email from a listener named Britt, who's in Milton. Britt writes, "We welcomed our first child in July 2023, and finding childcare proved to be a significant challenge. Thankfully, we eventually secured a spot in a program, but the cost has been overwhelming, currently around $1,400 per month. As middle-class Vermonters, we don't qualify for the new subsidies, which has been deeply disheartening. Feels like the wealthy can comfortably afford childcare, while lower-income families receive much-needed support. This financial strain is the primary reason we've had to reconsider the possibility of having more children." I'd love both of our guests to respond to this message. We'll start with you, Janet McLaughlin, with Department of Children and Families.
Well, sure. I think the first thing I would say is that the income limits changed on October 6th. So I would want to make sure that person has looked into it again since October 6th, because again, now the way that this was structured with the legislature, which, you know, Senator Hardy can speak to, was so that, you know, for families sort of up to the limit, you wouldn't have a cliff, especially if you just had one child. So I would just really, I would encourage this person to make sure that they're checking in with their local community child care support agency and confirming that they're not eligible for support. Mm,
thank you. And Senator Hardy, what are your thoughts for Britt in Milton?
Yes, I would underscore what Janet just said. We did phase in the increased eligibility income limits in order to be able to afford it and to make sure that we were collecting revenue to support the increased subsidies. And there are people who think we should go even higher with the subsidies, but of course that would cost even more money. So we are, the subsidies in Vermont do go up quite high to, and Janet, you would have the numbers better than me at this point, but up into, I think, around $170,000 per family of four. Is that correct,
yeah,
Janet?
Janet, could you share some of those numbers with us?
Yeah, I mean, for a family of four, it's $179,400 could be the gross annual income for that family. So that is, and that equates to 575% of the federal poverty line. It's how these things are sort of calculated. And so there will be another adjustment. The new federal poverty level limits will come out later this month, and we'll make another adjustment to the income scale probably sometime in February or into March.
Yeah, so those levels of subsidy going up that high of income is really, really unique. And so I do know there are families that are not covered, but in looking at the data when we were working on Act 76, it was very few families with young children do not qualify for the subsidies. Of course, they are out there, but we tried to really move the subsidies up through working class and middle class families so that there would be access to childcare to it for as many families as possible in Vermont.
Hmm. We have Lisa calling in from Shelburne. Lisa, what are your thoughts on this conversation we're having today?
Well, I am encouraged by the funding changes and the commitment. And I want to speak a little bit to the in-house daycare and along with the funding, looking at the processes that helps get these daycares up and coming. And I've been a school administrator for 20 years and then recently was helping a friend who is a extremely experienced early childhood teacher open up a home daycare. And I almost couldn't get through all of the regulations and the paperwork. And then the STARS has to be done separately. And I can't imagine what it's like for other providers who don't have an administrative background to simply get through all of the regulations that they need to. It almost feels, to be honest, kind of punitive and a lack of trust that these providers can do their job. And I know the intentions are all well and to protect children, but 120 pages or so in that manual seems excessive and a hurdle.
That does seem like a lot, though I don't know the specifics of the regulations you're talking about, Lisa. I'm wondering if Janet McLaughlin, if you know of any efforts to simplify this process for childcare providers.
Yeah, she's right. It is a process, right? We're talking about, you know, the safety and, you know, healthy development of some of our youngest Vermonters, some of our most vulnerable Vermonters. So it is a process. There are both federal requirements and state requirements. For the Child Development Division, for our child care licensing team, we've got a team of technicians and licensors that really work hand in hand with programs to help them get started. Help walk them through the, can provide lots of assistance to help walk them through the requirements. And we also have partnered with another nonprofit in Vermont, First Children's Finance, that can provide technical assistance on startups, can provide business planning support. So we do recognize that this, you know, opening up a regulated childcare program is a serious undertaking, and it should be. It's caring for our youngest children, and fortunately right now we're able to support it with additional financial resources as well as additional technical assistance.
Hmm. Well, let me share one more email before we have to wrap this segment up. This is from Bridget, who lives in New York but works in Middlebury. And she writes, as a mother, I'm offended when financial assistance is tied to employment. Too many parents are expected to turn their children over to others, go to work, and know that the cost of care leaves a very small amount left over. I understand that many people are career-focused and want to have childcare available, but that shouldn't create a mandate that all parents do that. If we're going to subsidize the care of children, that amount should be available to a parent as well. And Senator Hardy, it sounds like Bridget is kind of implying that maybe there is a way to also support parents who choose to stay home financially rather than just supporting parents who are sending their kids to a child care center. Has this come up at all? Do you have any thoughts for Bridget there?
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, as Janet mentioned, there are ways that parents can qualify for the subsidies if they're not working, if they're in training or education programs or some other work preparation kind of programs. So we also, and I, this was something that I argued for pretty adamantly, was exactly what Bridget is suggesting, that the parents, regardless of their financial or their work situation, should be able to qualify for the subsidies. And the original bill did include a provision allowing for the subsidies to be for families that did not work. However, federal law requires that the subsidies for childcare, the Child Care Financial Assistance Program, is partially federally funded. And so there are federal requirements that require that families be either working or seeking employment or in education or training. So unfortunately, that doesn't, we weren't able to fully implement that. But there are other ways that we support families. Several years ago, we implemented a child tax credit, and that is for families with children ages 5 and under, and they receive a tax credit that's prorated based on their income for young children. And that tax credit can obviously be used for the care of children at home. So there are other ways that we work in our system to try to support families of young children besides child care subsidies.
Hmm. State Senator Ruth Hardy of Addison County, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Janet McLaughlin, the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Children and Families, thank you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
School boards across the state have a tough but important job this year, trying to support school kids' education while facing down constrained budgets and communities who are wearied by rising property taxes, which contribute to our education funding system. Amid this landscape, the Vermont School Board Association is trying to recruit Vermonters to join their local school board. It's a bit of a tough sell this year, but it is a crucial one. Here to tell us why is Floor Diaz-Smith, the president of the Vermont School Board Association. She's also the chair of the Washington Central School District and serves on the National School Boards Association. She lives in East Montpelier. Floor, welcome.
Thank you, Michaela. It's a pleasure to be here. Gracias for having me here. Go ahead.
Vermont has nearly 900 school board members. For someone who's unfamiliar with how this all works, what exactly does a school board member do?
So the essential mission of a school board, sort of in simple words, is to govern the school system on behalf of its community as a whole. So it is, in simple words, a guardian of its schools. The board serves as the trustee on behalf of the current citizens and the future citizens. So it simply said is we are at that 30 or 50,000 foot level. So looking from the balcony down, looking at the district policies, we monitor student outcomes and the finances, and we present the budget to the citizens for them to be able to vote in that budget. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a lot of work, and you have to have some pretty, you know, I would imagine extensive knowledge of your school system and how it works. What if somebody is interested in joining a school board or running for a school board seat, but they feel unprepared or lack this type of knowledge that they need?
Yeah, I think the main thing to remember is that you don't need to have any particular knowledge to be on the school board. It's more the willingness. I think people forget that we're at a pivotal moment in public education right now. And public education, as some of the other presenters were saying, remains that cornerstone of our democracy, right? So in our schools, it's the public education is that prerequisite for ensuring that we have political and civil rights. So if you care about ensuring that each and every student receives the opportunities that they need and can reach their full potential regardless of their circumstances, you want to run for school board. And we at the VSBA have the information that, that you need in order to ensure that, that you're prepared for, for that. So in Vermont, there's been an increasing number of school districts that have had to fill their positions by vacancies, right? So that means that they're appointed rather than running. So right now you have the opportunity to bring your petition. You need 30 signatures and your consent form to your town clerk or to the district clerk of your school district and serve, you know, to... But what would I say? I said it's just important to make sure that people understand that where we put our energy as citizens has great consequences for the future of Vermont, and serving in your public education and your school board, it really shapes the lives of not just of students but also families, educators, and influences how our communities. Set the conditions for a better future for Vermont.
When did you first decide that you wanted to be on a school board?
So I've been a school board member for 15 years now, and I became a citizen to become a school board member because I
became a U.S. citizen.
Guatemala became a U.S. citizen, which is a requisite. It's required in order to run for a school board. So up until then, I just had my green card. And then once I understood the importance of public education and how that shapes, you know, the rule of law and the democracy that you have here, it was something that it was not something I grew up with, right? I grew up with, you know, 30 years of civil war and not understanding how what a difference we can make as citizens in the future of our communities. So I became just really involved in how to understand better how to govern and understand better how to collaborate with others in order to make sure that public education stays as a cornerstone of our democracy and is supported in Vermont.
I'm curious what keeps you coming back and remaining part of this school board system that we have here after particularly difficult years like last year, where a lot of communities were divided over school budgets and costs. What helped you face those challenges?
I think it's reminding myself that, you know, there's more to stake than just the day to day. I love the connection with our communities and how I think overall we all want what is best for our children, and it's not an either or situation. School board members are taxpayers too. And the challenge we have faced is, you know, how do we all come together to support high quality, equitable, and sustainable education that is mindful of the fiscal realities, but without forgetting that is critical. And even if the circumstances we face are really complex, it brings us together every year with the opportunities to craft a more solution-oriented approach, right? To ensure the well-being of our students is so important, you know, and that's what keeps me coming back to them, the kids, right? Every time you visit the school, every time that you're at that graduation on June, whenever the graduation is for your district, and you see that miracle of public education, regardless of your circumstances, you have, you know, 100 kids, however many kids there are in your district, graduating together and starting, you know, they're the future citizens of whether it's Vermont or or moving out of state, we're interconnected. You know, you just had a guest from Colorado, right? Like, we all are interconnected, and it's so important to serve the public of Vermont. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that there are some deadlines coming up in this process for being a candidate for school board. Could you tell us about those? How exactly the logistics work?
Yeah, and I can they can visit the website of Vermont School Boards Association and go to their local clerk and ask instructions. But right now, you need your petition with 30 signatures from the town that you live, or if you're in a district, it can be anybody from the towns that represent your district. And then the consent form, you can download it for the website at your town clerk. You can call your town clerk, or you can download it from the website at the state. And that's really all you need for running for school board. And you can also approach your school board chair in your district or the superintendent in your district. But it's best to approach your school board chair if you have questions, specifics of how much the time commitment is, or other questions about when the meetings are happening. But
And Fleur, you mentioned that if not enough people run for the school board in a certain district, the school board will need to appoint members. Has there ever been a situation that you're aware of here in Vermont where there just hasn't been anyone available, maybe in a very small school district, to be a member? Nobody willing to be appointed even, and there have had to be seats that are vacant?
Yes, absolutely. At any time given in the state, we have had 30 to 40 unfilled school board seats. And really, our students deserve full staff boards that are composed of, you know, people that are dedicated and qualified and elected by their voters, right? Mm. Every board has a different process for appointing school board members. But it's the process is all transparent, right? You interview and you appoint. Usually you get just one or two people, and every board has either questions or just write a letter of interest and you get appointed to your board. But it's totally different when you run, you talk to the members of your community. The school boards are the link to their communities, right? And they're the ones that set the vision for the district. They're the ones that make sure that the goals of the strategic plan are being met. They are the ones that make sure that your budget represents the values of the community and the core beliefs of your community, and, you know, transparent, responsible leadership and community engagement are probably two of my favorite things. I know that I'm very passionate, but I know what it is to not have public education, right? I know what it is. Even, you know, in Guatemala, we have public education, mm-hmm. but you invest less than a cent in every school. Mm-hmm. Less than a cent in every child, you know? So being able to have accountability to the use of public dollars is super important, and we get to respond to the challenges that we face. And like you were saying,
Fleur, I'm so sorry, Fleur. We have to wrap up the show here, but I so appreciate your passion for public education and your expertise. Thank you for joining us today.
Gracias, Michaela. Thank you.